Campus FM presents a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grandmaster's Palace, entitled The Lunettes, Sea Battles of the Knights. This talk is delivered by Mr. Liam Gauchi and is organized by the Office of the President.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Well, this day quite different from the other days, especially last lecture, when I thought that half of us at least would have caught a cold, because as soon as we went out, the cold north wind came rushing upon us. So, at last, the sun is bright. Also, Lemillo is quite well with us. Now, about this evening, first of all, I thank the President for again giving us this opportunity this year to discover, as I have explained and shown in the program, the palace. And indeed, today it will be quite proper in the title, Rediscovering the Residence of the Grand Master's Palace. Because what we have this evening, as you know, last time I told you about our dear friend Joseph Muscat, who is still in hospital but has been transferred to Karengrek Hospital, and he is undertaking physiotherapy. He seems to be well on the way to recovery. As you can imagine, most of you know my character, I was upset, but in came our dear friend, Mr. Liam Gauchi, who told me, you take too many things at heart and too much. But in any case, he offered his services, and even until a few days ago, he was not so sure because he told me the time is too short. But he made a great effort. And also the great effort that was done by our dear friend, also Daniel Cilia. And together they made quite a good team. What is important about this evening lecture is that as they are, where they are, and how they are, it's impossible to decipher, to almost understand anything. Not only if you have a guide, but also through the naked eye. So, Daniel Cilia made what we may say the impossible, because he told me at some moment, and went high up a ladder, and there seems to have been some angel who kept him from falling down headlong, but he managed to do the photo. The important thing, that before falling, he took the photo. So, yes, sir. Mr. Liam Gauchi, thank you very much. Indeed, I am grateful to you for accepting to keep on the tradition now of this year about rediscovering the palace.
So, good evening, everybody. As Salvatore said, unfortunately, Mr. Joseph Muscat could not give this lecture. Joseph, who was and has been for a number of years, since I was a nauseating 15-year-old asking him questions about everything and anything that was nautical, has been my mentor and helped me so much throughout my studies. And I would like to, dedicate this effort that me and Daniel did through trying to create this presentation and this lecture to him, who he is a man who has given us so much when it comes to our maritime history. Today we're going to be talking about the lunettes which you see in the corridors of the palace, as well as paintings which are found in the tapestry chamber. Daniel managed to get some very, very interesting details about these paintings which are found in the palace. I am not an art historian, but I will be going through, in fact, I will not go through the merit, the artistic merit of these paintings. However, I will be going into the little details found in these paintings, which give us a much more colorful painting once we start to analyze them slowly. We'll start with the first slide, which is the launching of the new fleet. Just to put you into perspective, you can see here these square rigged ships from the date of 1705. 1705 was the date when the ships of the line were launched by the order. Now, the Order of St. John was mainly using constantly galleys, which we will be talking about them later on. These galleys, which are Latin rigged, and they started to modernize under Grandmaster Pereyos when the Grandmaster decided to move into the new century, upgrading the navy and keeping up with the times during the period. And Grandmaster Perellos decided, out of his own initiative, to start this new squadron of square-rigged ships, just like the ones we can see over there. Now, what is interesting about these ships and this painting in particular is that this is the first time where the ships went out of harbour to put on a beautiful display for all the locals in Malta. It is very interesting that these ships, the first ships, were all built at Toulon at a great expense. In fact, the Venetian representative of the Doge in Malta wrote to the Doge saying that there is a hint of corruption in the tendering of these ships. Yes, some things don't change. It is very interesting that these ships cost around three times as much than if they were built in Holland. Now, always remember, this is a spy, so he was quite biased against the French, especially. Always remember that Venice and France always had vested interests in the Eastern Mediterranean. But it's very interesting when we see the construction of these ships, which came at a great expense. In fact, for example, we know that one of the biggest problems was acquiring wood for these ships during a time when France was at war. And when the ships were being constructed, at times the whole construction was postponed because Louis XIV wanted to construct his ships to get ready for any naval engagement that his empire, France, was going to be involved in. But apart from that, finally, the ships were launched in 1705. And this is a detail from the first painting, we can call it, in the series of these lunettes about the ships of the line. And what is interesting is these little boats over here of the Barclora, the boats which we still see in our harbour today, ferrying people from one side to the other of the harbour. These boats, which, although slightly more rigid, the boats which are being built today, back then these boats were being used in harbour. And back then as well, they were generating a lot of money for the local people who were living around the harbour. These Barclora, we get to find that there is so much interesting stuff of what they were carrying around. For example, when the fleet was about to leave, these Barclora were employed to carry all the food stuff, for example. You get interesting details, receipts of, for example, a baker in Isla who is actually getting the bread to the ships, and he is paying a barclor to take his bread. You get merchants who had their botarga and their salted tuna, which was brought from Sicily, kept in their stores, and they actually employ a particular boatman to ferry their stuff to the ships, to the fleets of the order and of the corsair ships. Once these ships were out at sea, also these bumboatmen were being employed to carry, for example, sailors who actually slept through the calling up of the crew, and they had to hurry to the harbour and be ferried onto their ships. It's very, very interesting that usually ships were given, the crew of the ships were given around 24 hours to know that their ship is leaving, and 24 hours to arrive at the dockside and to go on board. You get all these little petitions at the Tribunale degli Armamenti in Indina, and you find, for example, actually a sailor who is taken to court by the Admiralty because he was late in embarking on board ship. And you find the reasons he gets for not being able to make it is that the cart he was coming onto from for example Rabat or some example from Gozo, but we'll stick to this character from Rabat. His karatun broke down and he wasn't able to make it on time. There was this man from Gozo, the sailor from Gozo, who actually did not arrive in harbor because the Gozo boat never left, because there was a farmer who had some mutton to transport to Valletta, and the captain of the small Gozo boat was waiting for the mutton to arrive, and he arrived late. And you start getting these little details, and you start seeing, you know, the colorful aspects of what was going around the harbor. Thanks to Daniel, through the little detail, we can see all the boats all around the ships. We know that these boats used to leave, to stay for a number of minutes while the ship is leaving harbor, close to the boat, with all, for example, the wives of certain officers who are not knights, waving to their loved ones who are now leaving. And we also know that Grandmaster Verellos, on one of his gondolas, which was slightly larger than this boat, than these boats, was outside harbor close to St. Elmo on the day that these ships were leaving harbor for the first time. It is very interesting that one of the reasons why probably we don't have the actual reason why these lunettes were actually commissioned. But one of the reasons might be that Grandmaster Verellos faced a lot of problems when he decided to build this new squadron. All the older knights would not accept that the galley squadron was not enough for the defense of Malta, that we needed, that Malta needed the introduction of the square-rigged ships. And probably Grandmaster Verellos wanted to show off quite that, listen, these are going to be very successful, and in fact, they were. But the more we look at these lunettes, the more we see certain details by the artist which start to indicate that the man who was painting these lunettes, he was very conversant with life at sea. And the little details that you see are absolutely amazing. One of them is a becalmed ship. You can see that the ship was sailing, as we say, against the wind, and you can see the sails, which are actually pushed against the masts. Now, this was a common occurrence, and we have particular references where the ships of the line of Malta, these were not oar-powered like the galleys, so they needed wind to move. We know that sailing out of harbor, at times the local barclora were actually paid to tow the ships out of harbor, for example. And just imagine, such a ship, becalmed, could not move, and so the boatmen were employed in towing the ship out of harbor. But in this particular painting, it is very interesting to see that this artist knew what he was painting, because we know through manuals about sailing from the period that once the ship was sailing against the wind, there was a huge chance that the yardarms would split. The yardarms are these over here. Can you see that they have just split? Because the wind is coming from the wrong direction, the sailors did not have time to drop sail or to maneuver the rigging, and so the yardarm has split in two. This painting is really interesting when it comes to these details of sailing. This is another painting, and we can see the ships of the line in all their glory firing a broadside. A broadside means that one side of the ship where all the cannons are found on these ships, the square-rigged ships, the ships of the line, cannons were found to the sides of the ships, while the galleys, which we'll be talking later on, have the cannons to the front. You can see that this ship is firing a whole broadside. You can see the thick smoke, which you can see there. And it was a broadside was fired on different occasions, One broadside was fired against the enemy, but another broadside at times was also fired to salute other ships which were close by, ships which were of friendly nations, or ships which were of the corsair ships, which were part of the Order's fleet, which were the paramilitary part of Malta's navy at the time. And we know, for example, an interesting reference is that captains, corsair captains, going out of harbour, and they see the ships of the line. The ships of the line will fire. No, sorry. First, the corsairs would fire a salute. Then the order's ships will salute the corsair ships. We also know that once the ships of the line were out at sea and could sight the parish church of Zabar, the Madonna of Graces, the order ships would give a 21 gun salute to the Madonna of Graces. It's very, very interesting, and it's very particular. These little details, you get them from the logbooks of the ships. And it's so interesting that the great devotion that the navy of the order had towards the Madonna of Zabar. Now, apart from the saluting, a broadside was given in full, in all, its anger against an enemy ship. Carnage on board ship during the battles was something to behold. Here you can see a full broadside of the order's ship over here against a Turkish ship. Now, what is interesting is that tactics during battle varied from one admiral and from one captain to another. We'll start off with a certain Chambray, who was a very successful admiral and captain of the ships of the line. He had quite an audacious tactic. His tactic was fire at the hull of the ship. So once the enemy saw that their ship was leaking, they would surrender. He was a bit too audacious, and it's documented that he was one of the most audacious captains, and he was very successful in his tactics. But usually the ships used to fire at the rigging and at the masts. As you can see, this ship here, the enemy ship, is dismasted. Now, the artillery on board the Maltese were renowned to be very good artillerymen, very good gunners. In fact, there was a huge reputation of the Maltese gunners being one of the best gunners in the Mediterranean. In fact, they were also very well paid on board. And as a confraternity, in fact, they constructed the chapel, the Santa Barbara chapel in Valletta, the first chapel you walk across on your right when you're walking through Republic Street, is Santa Barbara, the chapel of Santa Barbara, actually constructed by the confraternity of the gunners, the Santa Barbara confraternity. It is also very interesting that the gunners of the order, the French artillery corps, were actually took a lot of information and a lot of details from the way the Maltese were being trained and were using their tactics on board ship. But these gunners were very good at their job because they got very good training. We get various instances where captains actually stop outside harbour before leaving onto the Corso or onto the crews of the ships, where they train for 2 hours, 3 hours on end at the batteries, firing from one side to another. First the port battery fires, then the starboard battery fires, 3 hours of constant training. It was the main aim to subdue your enemy before actually boarding the enemy. You have to subdue your enemy with good gunnery, very good aiming. And you get this through numerous logbooks where actually after one broadside, the enemy of the usually Barbary Corsairs or the Ottoman Navy actually surrender before any bloodshed was the combat actually started. The order would fire a whole broadside, the enemy would drop its sails, all its sails, as a sign of surrender. And you get this a lot through a lot of the logbooks, especially for the order and also for the Corsair ships. The Corsair ships, which were also using such ships as the ones that we see over here, one of the largest ships recorded, privately owned by a Maltese captain, had around 64 guns. That is, which in a line of battle, we can call them as third rates. The order, the largest ships it had, were 64 gun ships. Just imagine Corsairs, privately owned by Maltese men, a 64-gun ship, such as the ones we can see here. And a lot of the times, these Corsairs, for example, actually subdued their enemy by one broadside. Usually, for example, hitting away at the main mast, as we can see from this painting. Now, we have been talking about the square-rigged ships. We may move on to the galere, the galleys of the order, which were quite much more, had been started to being used in the Navy much earlier than the square-rigged ships, but they were the most commonly ships used by the order's Navy and by the local Corsairs. Now, this is a lunette, which is from Grandmaster Pinto's time. Now, Grandmaster Pinto, as we all know, was quite a character. And again, first of all, we'll start off that the artist who was painting this painting was, again, conversant with nautical ongoings of the period. All the galleys before battle used to slit the sails. Can you see here? They are slitting the sails so that the ships will slow down and the artillery could have enough time to aim and fire the cannons. Now, what is interesting about this is you can see there at the back the flag of Grandmaster Pinto, a grandmaster who actually started off a phenomenon in Maltese maritime history. That is when he started trying to get the local Corsairs to use his flag, the quartered flag, which you can see, where you can see the flag of the religion over here, then the coat of arms of the Grand Master. That was a flag used by a lot of the Corsairs and at times by the order's Navy. If the ship which was being used was flying that flag, it meant that Greek merchants who had their merchandise on Ottoman ships, on Corsair ships, could not appeal to Rome. That means that the Grandmaster Pinto, who was one of the first who started this off, these Greeks could not appeal to the Pope. The Pope could not get on the back of the Grandmaster, and there was more money in the coffers coming into the order and to the local Corsairs. And this Grandmaster Pinto was really, really injecting a lot of his effort into these sort of ventures. In fact, a painting, which is Edward Alla Felis, which was commissioned by Grandmaster Pinto, which shows as well a galley in action, was captained by a certain Captain Zelalich, who was quite a favorite with Grandmaster Pinto. And while Grandmaster Pinto was giving money to this Captain Zelalich to go around the Mediterranean attacking anything and everything that pertained to the Ottoman Empire, he was writing letters to the Pope telling him that the Maltese ships had not ventured into the Levant for over 10 years. It's so interesting that while he's writing this letter, he's actually commissioning an artist to paint this painting. It's very, very interesting, but even more so is that we have to also start realizing that these ships of the Order of St. John and of the Corsairs were still, on the contrary to popular belief, were still venturing into the Levant, were still venturing into around Greek islands, were still venturing as far off as Cyprus and also as Anatolia. even as late as the 1790s. Enough about Grandmaster Pinto, and we move on to another painting, which is in the tapestry chamber. Again, I would like to look at an interesting detail which is found in these paintings. You could see beforehand those galleys in full sail with that Latin sail showing. These galleys look very, very strange, but on closer look, it shows again how the artist was conversant with nautical terms. Before battle, when the captain had time to prepare for battle, he would dismast the galley so that he could have a better aim with his artillery, and so that the enemy would not aim at the masts of the galleys. And so you can see here that these three galleys are preparing for battle. Even more interestingly is the color of the galleys. The color of the Maltese galleys was red. Now, there are varying reasons why the galleys were painted red. One interesting reason was the amount of bloodshed on board. And so, once the galleys were painted red, during battle, when there was bloodshed, soldiers would not be alarmed about the situation. We know through various diaries that there was so much bloodshed on board that we have a diary of this time of a corsair who actually slips on the deck on the blood of his compatriots, hits his head, and the next thing he knows, he's a prisoner in Algiers. Luckily, he came back, he lived to tell the story, luckily for us. We move on to another painting, which is, again, very interesting. I always compare this to the tactics used by the order, especially with the galleys. I compare them to ants surrounding a cockroach, a dead cockroach, and they're going onto all these little ants going to pick onto the dead cockroach. Sorry for that comparison, but just to give you the idea, a lot of the Turkish ships during the period were quite larger than the galleys, as you can clearly see from this painting. And you can see that the galleys are very low-lying, while the enemy ship is quite higher than that. Usually, the ships, the galleys, used to work in conserva. That means together. And these ships used to try and outsail, outmaneuver a square-rigged ship. Excuse me. Always remember that the galleys had an advantage over square-rigged ships such as this. They had oars, so if the wind calmed down, they could ply their oars, they could row, gain momentum, and surround the enemy ship. Very interestingly, it's always remembered, there were around 700 men on these ships, on these galleys, around 200 to 250 tied slaves on the benches, men who could not move around, they had to stay on the benches, tied to the benches. Even to relieve themselves, they had to relieve themselves underneath the benches. We get references, for example, that before you see a galley at sea, you will smell it. It was very smelly business on board, but an attack, as I was saying earlier, was conducted from the front of the galley, and there you can see the Rambata, found in the documents as the più onorato posto a bordo, the most honorable place to be. And that is where the knights and the soldiers were usually found before a boarding commenced. You can see slightly that the men there getting ready for assailing the enemy ship. There used to be huge wooden boards protecting the soldiers from any enemy fire. Then, once the galley had fired the broadside, usually a broadside was fired only when the gunner could see the white of the eyes of the enemy ship, the sailor's white. And the technical term of it all was, you only shoot when you see the white of their eyes. And they will wait for that. Once they fire a whole broadside, then the boards came down and the soldiers would grapple onto the enemy ship and try and win the day. As I said, if the enemy would not surrender by the first broadside, then you had to board the enemy ship. From the front, we'll move on to the back part of the galera, the most beautiful, the most expensive part of the ship, the carros. The carros, thanks to Joseph Muscat, one of the most interesting references to the carros. You can see, beautifully ornate, usually all gilded, in so beautiful, all sculptures, all sculpted. It's where the captain and the knights stayed when the battle, when there was no battle. During the day, that's where all the knights stayed. That's where they ate their dinners and their lunch. But the most interesting thing is that each galley had a different carros, different sculptures at the back of each galley. And when a galley was going to be launched, there was a competition. A competition for local artists to submit their designs, and then a commission would choose the nicest design. We have an interesting petition where an artist who went beyond the call of duty, and instead of designing his bozzetto on paper, he decided to make a wax model for the commission. He was not chosen, and somebody else was chosen, and he actually appealed to the Tribunale degli Armamenti for some money for the amount of wax he wasted in trying to make this model and then not getting the job. Unfortunately, we do not know if he actually got any money for this model, but again, through the details from these paintings, we actually see, for example, that each galley, for example, had a wooden statue of a particular saint on the carros, which was usually somewhere over here. You can't see it because of the flag. But at the top, where the shadow of the paper is, you can see a statue, probably of a particular saint. Usually these galleys had the San Michele, the Madonna del Pilar, all had a particular saint, and all had a particular wooden statue on board. Talking about the heat of battle, there you can see a very interesting detail of sailors climbing onto the rigging of the enemy ship. Can you see them over there? Holding a sword and shield in hand. Battles, as I said, usually there was a lot of carnage on board. But it's interestingly, a lot of the men did not die during battle. The men would die or afterwards because of lack of usually the doctor did not have time to see to all the patients. And so they would die when they lose too much blood, for example, gangrene later on. It was a bit complicated, but during battle, there weren't a lot of casualties. An interesting battle that occurred quite later on from these paintings, we're talking about the 1780s, of a corvette captained by Captain Felice McCullough, who was a Maltese corsair who had on board with him two Maltese knights. They were close to an island, to the island of Santorini, and a Turkish frigate came into sight, and Captain McCullough decided to attack the enemy ship. We know that Captain McCullough fired around 50 broadsides. That means 50 times the cannons of the ships were employed. By this time, the cannons of the ship were so hot that usually you could not actually touch the barrel. And when the cartridge was rammed into the cannons, at times the whole thing exploded, causing huge havoc on deck before it actually fired on the enemy. We know that after these 50 broadsides, Captain McCullough came closer to the enemy ship, usually using grappling hooks, these huge iron hooks which we have a number of these examples at the Maritime Museum, you would actually swing the grappling hook onto the enemy ship, and together you would use to get around 40 men actually pulling the ship closer to your ship. Once that is close enough, you would fire your muskets, your blunderbusses, called in the documents Scopa Coperta, which means clear the decks. These blunderbusses, which work just as sort of shotguns, you fire these muskets to make sure that the enemy deck is clear. Then you jump onto the enemy ship. Those men over there usually were called scapoli, which means men who have, you know, you have nothing in life but a scapoli. And you jump onto the enemy ship and try to capture the ship. During this particular engagement that I have been describing of Felice Mikallef, only 3 men died during the battle out of a crew of around 200 men. What is very interesting is from the logbook we get to see that they were so not used to men dying during the battle that the crew were actually scared to board the enemy ship when they saw that 3 of their men had fallen dead instantly from the first firing of the enemy muskets. But usually this was the way of the battle. That's how the whole system worked step by step. But sometimes we do get very, very interesting references in the logbook. At times, very perplexing and very strange. And this is one of my favorite occurrences at sea. We're talking about 1786, when Captain Gavaza was sailing close to Tripoli. And this is, of course, not a painting of this particular incident, but I took this detail so to explain the story. And Captain Gavaza, his lookout on the topmast, sighted an enemy ship. The crew were beaten to quarters, and everybody got ready for battle. The Maltese hoisted the grandmaster's flag and fired one cannon shot. Suddenly, the Guardia Riva, which is the man who's at the topmast looking out at sea at the enemy ship, was stunned and saw that the Turks were actually setting fire to their ship so they would not get caught by the Maltese corsairs. It's a very interesting reference that the Ottomans and the Turks, which were on board this ship, preferred to set fire to their powder magazine and jump into the sea than face the Maltese corsairs. And you can see there a ship on fire from one of the paintings in the tapestry chamber. Another interesting detail from one of these paintings is this boat being rowed close to shore with a landing party. Usually, certain attacks were done by hand-to-hand combat. Men were landed on foreign territory, and they would go inland to steal and take anything and everything that was found and return back to shore. Usually, the ships of the order had a felucca, a small boat, a low-lying boat, and that is a felucca in one of the paintings, and you can see it crowded with men, all having boarding pikes, blunderbusses, pistols, half-swords. These men were actually armed to the teeth. Once they land, they would cause havoc around the countryside, around the lands that they were landing. At times, they did such excursions, if we can call them that, met with success. Other times, they were met with huge failures. Only one of the most recent references we have come across was, for example, that a crew sighted a herd of goats and a lot of shepherds close by. The crew were landed, around 25 men were landed. Once they landed on land, they realized that they were not the herds were not goats, but camels, and they were surrounded instantly by cavalrymen from the local villages in North Africa. And this is another detail which, as I said, usually, of course, in North Africa, in Greece, also in Dalmatia, in Anatolia, once they realized that a ship was close by and a landing party was going to be landed, usually the local militias in these parts of the Mediterranean would en masse and prepare for the eventual landing of the landing party, which was coming from aboard the ships. Various references are found about such instances. For example, when water was running low, usually water would not keep for more than 7 days, and so constantly such ships had to stop close to land, land their men, they would fill up water barrels and take them back to the ships. There are numerous instances when, for example, the landing party, the sailors are caught off guard and they have actually to fight their way back to their ship. And this is another detail from the frescoes in the tapestry chamber. After all those adventures at sea, the ships returned into harbour. And that there you can see the galley squadron returning to Malta. You can see I mentioned that all the galleys were usually painted red, but the flagship was painted black, and you can see that the first galley entering the harbour was the Capitana, with all painted black. But the interesting detail is that it is dragging the enemy colours behind it. Can you see Turkish flags being dragged into harbour by the Capitana as a show of victory? This was a time of great pageantry in harbour, as I mentioned earlier. And you can see that the full fleet is coming into harbour. What is interesting is that this painting is showing various times of the day in one painting. So before the galley fleet actually entered harbour, it had to go to the La Tarepa. Can you see? There, the galleys moored close to Manuel Island. And that is where, again, the Barque Laura came into the picture. We have interesting references that show, for example, that the Barque Laura were actually employed by pimps to take prostitutes to Manuel Island for the sailors which were in harbour, which had come in harbour after 3 months, 2 months at sea. The details also that we get from this painting, for example, the roof, Baraka, the lower Baraka and the upper Baraka from this painting, you can see over there. Another interesting thing is Del Monte Gate over there, which was for so many years the main gate into Valletta. That is another detail, as you can see, of the Lazzaretto, where all the galleys had to undergo quarantine before they entered into harbour. That was the end of my lecture.
Well, thank you, Liam. It's been such an entertaining lecture. Thank you also for stepping in to solve this big problem. I would like to add two small points, because there is still raging the question whether Napoleon would have won Malta or not. There is a sort of controversy between Stephen Spiteri, you know, he's an expert on fortifications, and the late Carmelo Testa. Both of them, I asked them the same question that the gentleman has asked. Carmelo Testa said they would never have won Valletta, because his ideas. During the last war, a bomb fell, it only broke a little, but they would never. But Stephen said, my dear friend, because I'm his friend, what would the Maltese have done against 200 ships with all this latest armament? So the controversy is still raging. Go ahead.
Napoleon had spies in high places. So, for example, when the militia, the Maltese militia, were issued with cartridges to use against the landing French troops, they were given cartridges instead of black powder with coal, with dust, coal dust. They were, instead of lead balls, they had leather pellets. So, and even the Maltese started to think that, you know, everybody, they put everybody in the same boat. They thought all the French knights were against them. It's very complicated. Would the Maltese have withstood a bombardment? In fact, Grandmaster Hompesch actually received a petition from some local merchantmen, please surrender Valletta, we don't want to be bombarded. There were people who believed in the French, in the French ideal, in the Republican ideal. It's very complicated. I always say it's not black or white, it's grey, I think.
And another point I found out in one of these dictionaries of pirates, that in England, in Queen Elizabeth's time, there was a small player, all sailors, before sailing out of the British port, English ports. This little player said, please God, protect us against tempests and against Maltese corsairs. So, I thank you very much. Hope to see you in the next lecture.
You have just listened to a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grandmaster's Palace, entitled The Lunettes, Sea Battles of the Knights. This talk was delivered by Mr. Liam Gauchi and was organized by the Office of the President.